From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And fiscal crises are catching everyone's attention today. Jeremy, we're keeping an eye on a Greece on the brink, but there's much more.
There is, and it's much closer to our own shores in Puerto Rico, the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. And the governor there wants Wall Street lenders to postpone bond payments and restructure the island's $72 billion in debt because Puerto Rico just cannot pay it. Now, $72 billion is not anywhere near the debt of Greek proportions, but it is four times the amount of debt that drove the city of Detroit to bankruptcy. NPR's Greg Allen joins us from San Juan in Puerto Rico. And Greg, we're facing a deadline tomorrow, July 1st. What is the latest in Puerto Rico now?
Well, Jeremy, what we know is that the governor has asked Wall Street, as you mentioned, to give him a break, give Puerto Rico a break, so they don't have to make payments on their debt payments for a few years is what he's asking for, which seems like it might be unlikely. But what everyone agrees on is that Puerto Rico has severe structural problems with its economy, things like, you know, people leaving the island in droves. So you've got a shrinking population. The island hasn't seen economic growth for years. And they have recently raised taxes, but they have a severe tax evasion problem here. So revenues keep falling. And meanwhile, a succession of governments, of administrations here, have borrowed heavily from Wall Street to cover budget deficits. What's happened in the last year is that all the credit has been cut off. They're expected to pay back what they owe, and there's a severe cash crunch. And so that's what they're looking at. July 1st, which is tomorrow, they have a bunch of payments due, hundreds of millions of dollars of payments. And it's really not clear at this point how much of that Puerto Rico will be able to pay.
And they are looking to Washington to help from the United States. And one of the things that's different about Detroit, about Puerto Rico than, say, Detroit, is that Detroit can file for bankruptcy and Puerto Rico can't. What are the other options that they have? Could there be a bailout? Could the U.S. change the laws and allow Puerto Rico to file for bankruptcy?
Well, I think you've really summed it up there. I mean, Puerto Rico has really no options now except to talk to its lenders, bondholders, hedge funds, the people who own Puerto Rican debt. As you say, Detroit was able to go to the courts and say, we're bankrupt, let's make a deal. And the courts oversaw that process. Puerto Rico wanted that same kind of power, at least for its public agencies, its power company, which is called PREPA, the Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority. They owe some $9 billion in debt, and they have huge debt payments due coming up soon as well. So Puerto Rico would like to be able to put PREPA into bankruptcy and then make a deal with its creditors. That's not going to be possible. A court struck down an effort to do that. The U.S. bankruptcy law makes a special exemption, does not allow Puerto Rico to claim Chapter 9 bankruptcy. Puerto Rico has gone to Congress, asked them to pass an exemption, allow them to access Chapter 9 bankruptcy, but there seems very little will in Congress to do so right now. So that leaves them with one option, which is to sit down with their lenders. That's what they've been doing for weeks and months now, and it's just a question now about who has the leverage, and that we really won't know until tomorrow, I think.
And Greg, I just want to back up a little bit for people who don't know much about Puerto Rico. You've been down there covering this. We talked to you not long ago about the trouble that Puerto Rico is in, but just give us a little bit of the basics about Puerto Rico and the kinds of things that people there can do. For example, they cannot vote in presidential elections in the U.S.
That's right, but they can vote in primaries. I mean, there's a lot about Puerto Rico that just kind of is mind-boggling. When you tell someone that they vote in the party primaries but not in the presidential election, that's kind of stunning. You know, they have a member of Congress. He's a non-voting member of Congress, the resident commissioner, they call him. They also are citizens, of course, but they don't pay U.S. taxes. They pay very steep taxes here in Puerto Rico. So, but, you know, it's a very special case here, Puerto Rico. And it's been for more than a century now a part of the U.S. and always this special case. And in a lot of times that's worked in Puerto Rico's favor. Right now, those kind of special case is not really helping Puerto Rico. They're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place and seeing very little sign from Washington that the big boys in Washington are going to come down and help them out of this mess.
NPR's Greg Allen speaking to us from San Juan, Puerto Rico, as we near a big debt deadline in Puerto Rico. Greg, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So again, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, not a state, but 46 states begin their new fiscal years tomorrow, and a handful haven't settled on their budgets. In Illinois, that means some state workers could go without pay, state services could be disrupted. In the past, when budgets haven't been settled, New Jersey shut down casinos, Pennsylvania shut down highway rest stops. There is some good news. For the most part, most other states are doing well after struggling through the Great Recession. So we thought this could be a good time to get an overview with Brian Sigrets, Director of State Fiscal Studies for the National Association of State Budget Officers. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So let's start with a roundup. Pennsylvania, Illinois, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Massachusetts haven't settled on budgets for the coming year. Talk about Wisconsin first.
Wisconsin has a couple different issues they're facing right now. One has to deal with transportation funding, which has been an issue for several states this year. Different governors and legislators have looked at increasing transportation spending this year after not investing in it too much during the downturn. Wisconsin is also dealing with an issue kind of more unique to itself right now, looking at possibly building a new basketball arena for the Milwaukee Bucks. So there's a couple different issues kind of holding up Wisconsin's budget as we speak.
Even though it's a pretty red-led state. You've got the Republican Governor Scott Walker, a Republican legislature, but Walker wants to borrow money for some of the road projects and for that new arena for the Bucks. And so it sounds like that's an intra-Republican division.
Yes, I'd say so right now.
Yeah.
Some of the states that haven't finished budgets are one party, but a lot of the states that haven't finished budgets are two different parties where the governor and legislature split control.
Right. Let's look at Illinois and New Jersey. There's a fight over money for state pensions, a huge issue for a lot of states. So what are states up against when it comes to that?
Yeah, a lot of states have made significant pension reforms since the downturn. We have about 40 states that have made pension reforms in one form or another since the recession, looking at things like increasing retirement age, increasing employee or employer contributions. But that's not to say that states have solved the pension underfunding issue. States continue to have to deal with it. Illinois and New Jersey are two states that have had some of the largest underfunding amounts, so they're starting to try to address it now. Illinois looked at it a year or two ago, but the court kind of threw out the settlement that they had done. New Jersey started to debate the issue of how much to put into their pensions to make up for some of the underfunding that occurred in years past.
Yeah, and so meantime in New Jersey, you've got a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor, Chris Christie, and in Illinois, you've got a Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, and a Democratic legislature. He wants things he calls structural changes, maybe property tax freeze, before he goes along with the Democratic tax proposal to pay for teacher pensions there. And we've talked about these splits. There are some, but in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, it's also a fight between two parties, a Democratic governor and Republican legislatures. And this is over raising taxes?
Yes, that's part of the issue. Pennsylvania is partly related to taxes. It's related to how much to increase education funding. Pennsylvania is also dealing with looking at privatizing their liquor stores, as I mentioned, dealing with pensions. New Hampshire, it's dealing with funding levels. Is the budget appropriately funded? And also looking at whether or not to cut some business taxes is part of the disagreement up there.
What about Republican governors who agreed to tax hikes? You've got Governor Sam Brown back in Kansas agreeing to an increase in the cigarette sales tax, and then Bobby Jindal in Louisiana who went along with a cigarette sales tax increase as well, but still managed to hold his no tax increase pledge.
Yeah, it's been an interesting year regarding taxes. I say, the past couple of years, we've seen more of a movement to cut taxes. This year, we're still seeing more of an emphasis on cutting taxes, some discussion about reducing personal income taxes while increasing things like sales tax and cigarette taxes. But there have been some states that have done tax increases or are considering tax increases. Nevada did one to partly increase education funding. Kansas increased their sales and cigarette taxes after dealing with some declines in their revenues there. There is a willingness a lot of states now to consider tax increases, but I think the overall sense is that more states are still looking at tax reductions instead of tax increases.
Well, you recently released a fiscal survey of states that shows states which are spending more are putting that money towards education not transportation improvements, even though that's been the call, although education certainly needs funding. So give us an overall look.
States are doing okay. They're not back to the levels where they were before the downturn in a lot of instances. But for the most part, states are doing okay. It's just a matter that it's been slow growth. It's been steady growth. We haven't seen a boom like we did coming out of some recession. So states are still facing increasing spending demands, relatively slow revenue growth. So they continue to have to make tough choices.
Yeah. That's Brian Sigrets, a director of state fiscal studies for the National Association of State Budget Officers, with sort of a Polaroid there, a photo of the status of states. Brian, thank you.
My pleasure.
In the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, when Americans were struggling to understand the long-term ongoing violence between Sunnis and Shia, historians pointed out that it took the U.S. 100 years after the Civil War to move to repair the divide with civil rights legislation. And after the slaughter at the AME Church in Charleston, it's obvious that there's more to do. But our next guest says racial tensions have never been repaired, never even been addressed. Brian Stevenson recently launched that initiative to mark where nearly 4,000 lynchings took place in the U.S. He asks, why is it in Germany you can't go 100 yards without appropriately seeing a marker where Jewish families were taken to their death? In the South, you can't walk 100 yards without seeing a monument to men who defended slavery. Brian is founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. They also represent people claiming racial injustice in the legal system. He's at Troy Public Radio in Montgomery, Alabama. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
Well, lots to chew on here. You say the shooting in Charleston was a failure of the U.S. to deal with its history of racial injustice. Now, a lot of people might get that the Civil War did not end slavery, that the true history that blacks were then re-enslaved by Jim Crow laws that prohibited voting and good educations. But what do you mean when you say that while other countries became societies with slaves, the U.S. was a slave society?
Well, I don't think most people get that we have never really confronted the legacy of slavery and the narrative of racial difference that was created to justify slavery. Mm. There was slavery all over the world. There was slavery in Africa. But in most countries, slavery was a transitional status. It was something that wasn't defined by race or ethnicity. In the United States, people who were slave owners wanted to feel moral and just and Christian. And so they came up with this ideology of white supremacy. They basically concluded that black people are different. They're not as smart as other people. They're not as hardworking. They have these deficits. And we're doing something civil by enslaving them. And that narrative of racial difference was never confronted by our country. And that's why I argue that slavery didn't really end in 1865. And we see it dramatically at the turn of the century when lynchings and racial violence and terror was utilized to maintain this racial hierarchy, this racial subordination, to reinforce this narrative of racial difference.
Well, and you would go further, and others would agree with you, that it continued in order to sort of achieve that notion that blacks were inferior. People made sure that they were. Lack of education, lack of jobs.
It's one of the really heartbreaking stories of our country. There was a recognition at the end of the Civil War that you had to give people the right to vote, give them the opportunities for education and employment, and that was just crushed, taken away violently when Reconstruction collapsed. You know, the demographic geography of this country was shaped by terrorism. You have African Americans in Boston, in Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Los Angeles, Oakland, and very few people realized that the African Americans in these cities did not come there as immigrants looking for new economic opportunities. They came as refugees and exiles from terror. At the beginning of the 20th century, 90% of the African-American population lived in the Deep South. Over the next 30 years, the Great Migration, millions fled, and they fled terror. Yeah. And even as we got into the Civil Rights era, I think we did a really poor job of confronting the damage done by decades of segregation. I get a little frustrated, actually, when I hear people doing all of the celebratory things we do now to mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington or the Civil Rights Act. I mean, the truth is that for decades in this country, African Americans were humiliated every day. They were burdened. They were badgered. They were belittled. And you're not going to recover from something extended like that by just simply signing a law.
So I'm going to jump in because, as you well know, Brian, I can almost hear the howls of protest from the whites who consider themselves liberal and caring, who said, wait, I marched with blacks. I scorned the Jim Crow laws of the South. I did not participate in this.
Well, we all participated in it. And it's not to minimize the heroic struggle we made to overcome these laws, but the laws were just one part. The real heart of the problem was the narrative of racial difference. It was the way we see people of color. It's the presumption of dangerousness and guilt that got assigned to people of color. And that presumption of dangerousness and guilt still lives today. It's the reason why young people are protesting on the streets after unarmed black men have been shot. And no one can just sort of isolate themselves and say, but I did one good thing and therefore am not culpable for this. We are all culpable. That doesn't mean that we should just beat ourselves up. It just means we have to commit ourselves to truth and reconciliation, to
something
transitional.
Well, let me ask you about that. What would you want? You say truth and reconciliation. And by the way, people might also say in response to what you're saying, that's all in the past. That's ancient history. We have to move forward. But after last week, we may not hear that as much. And we saw movement in the South that you would not have seen previous to last week of calls for the Confederate flag to be taken down. When you say reconciliation, what are you talking about? Because I want to play you something. You say we have to talk about this. But recently, President Obama, at that eulogy he gave for Pastor Clementa Pinckney, who was killed at the AME church, he said we talk too much. Let's listen.
None of us can or should expect a transformation in race relations overnight. Every time something like this happens, somebody says we have to have a conversation about race. We talk a lot about race.
So, Brian Stevenson, we talk a lot about race. Your thoughts?
I don't think we talk a lot about race. I think we talk around race a lot. I'm not interested in just talking. I'm interested in transformation. Look, I live in a state where Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday, where Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. We do not have Martin Luther King Day in Alabama. We have Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day.
You make a very provocative comment in that light. You say, can anyone imagine having an Osama bin Laden birthday? Really?
Well, I think, you know, as an African-American whose great-grandparents were enslaved, the architects and defenders of slavery are not heroes. I don't think we should relate to the history of slavery and racial oppression with pride. Lynching was terrorism. And we can't relate to the architects and defenders of lynching as if they were heroes. And so, yes, I think in most parts of the world, when someone tries to destroy a country, when someone does something abusive, we don't celebrate them. And in Germany, there is a history of horrific misconduct. And no one would think it's appropriate to celebrate Adolf Hitler's birthday. We don't romanticize the architects of the Holocaust. Slavery and terrorism has no place of honor in our history. And we're not going to get where we're trying to go until we reverse that, until we talk more honestly about what that means. We've got 59 markers and monuments to the Confederacy in my hometown of Montgomery, and nary a word about slavery. That's the other part of it that's so provocative.
And obviously that's part of your mission to mark the places where there was this history of slavery, where slaves came and went in the country and places where lynching took place. But what else does this look like? What else in your mind does this conversation, this addressing of race, look like?
I think it's what transitional justice looks like in many parts of the world. It's creating a space for us to deal mournfully with the past, those things that should be mourned, to express our shame, our regret.
You mean like physical places?
You know, I do think what's happened in Germany is a good model. I mean, if you go to Germany, you are forced to see the places where Jewish families were abducted. They want you to go to the concentration camps and reflect soberly on that history. And that gives you a relationship, a way of coping with that history that's designed to protect those dynamics from ever manifesting themselves again, but also gives the nation a way forward. You know, I think we've got a generation of people who are white in this country who were born into households where they were taught, either directly or indirectly, that they're better than other people because they're white. And that's a terrible thing. And I want those communities to be liberated from the burden of racial bias. We are all compromised by this, not just people of color.
Brian Stevenson, you talk about the horrors, the terrorism of slavery and lynching. But it's also the, as you've said, everyday insults. Could you just share your story as a lawyer?
Yeah, I think one of the things that, I mean, people say, oh, you're talking about the past. No, this is really alive today, these presumptions of dangerousness and guilt, the way in which we look at each other, the implicit bias we all carry around. I was doing a case in the Midwest just a couple of years ago, and I was in a courtroom doing a hearing for the first time. I had my suit on. I had my shirt and tie on. I was at defense counsel's table, and the judge walked in, and he saw me sitting there, and he said, hey, you get back out there in the hallway. I don't want any defendant sitting in my courtroom without their lawyers. You wait out there until your lawyer gets here. And I stood up and I said, I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Brian Stevenson. I am the attorney. And the judge started laughing. And the prosecutor started laughing. And I made myself laugh because I didn't want to disadvantage my client. The client came in, a young white man I was representing, and we did the hearing. But afterward, I was thinking, what is it that when this judge sees a middle-aged black man in a suit and tie at counsel's table, it doesn't occur to him that that's a lawyer. What that is this implicit bias, this narrative of racial difference, this presumption that complicates our relationships. And until we deal with it, until we acknowledge it, until we proactively go after it, we're not going to make progress. The status of women in society has changed radically over the last 50 years. We've learned things that are not appropriate. We've learned how to respect, in some spaces, the idea that women can be attorneys and doctors. We still have a long way to go, but we've done it by confronting it. And we need to do the same thing when it comes to race. And it's quite tragic the way this plays out in the lives of so many people.
That's Brian Stevenson. Brian, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
The Los Angeles City Council has given authorities there the ability to speed up the dismantling of homeless encampments, which have been multiplying in Los Angeles. One reason to do that is to clean up the streets. Another is because studies show that when homeless people with chronic diseases get off the streets, their health improves. So should federal health care dollars be used to house the homeless? Anna Gorman from Kaiser Health News reports.
Joe Parra is singing and playing his acoustic guitar. He's at an afternoon music jam at the Star Apartments in downtown Los Angeles. Parra spent years living in tents and friends' backyards. Then he got hit by a car and ended up in the hospital.
So I would have had to not only deal with homelessness, but deal with it in a wheelchair with my leg up.
The LA County Health Department handpicked Parra to live in one of the new apartments. Now he's walking again.
So they helped set me up here. As you can see, I've recovered.
The modern building, in the middle of Skid Row, has an art studio, a garden, and a medical clinic. It's part of a multi-million-dollar experiment. Use local health dollars to help house the sickest, most vulnerable homeless residents. Mark Trotz heads LA County's Housing for Health program.
Having them come off the street is 50% of the battle right there.
The project has been successful at saving money in LA County. Now, California wants to try something similar statewide. It's proposing to use federal Medicaid dollars to help get more chronically homeless people into housing and keep them there. Mary Cantwell with the State Department of Healthcare Services says the plan would benefit both homeless residents and taxpayers.
They will have better health outcomes, better quality of life, and overall healthcare costs will be reduced.
Nationwide, other cities are also moving homeless people into what's known as permanent supportive housing. Research shows that once there, they go to the hospital less and their stays are shorter. But critics say Medicaid money is limited and should only be used for medical care. Lonhee Chen teaches law and public policy at Stanford University.
We have to draw the line somewhere, and that line should be drawn more directly related to the provision of health benefits.
At the Los Angeles Apartments, owned by the Skid Row Housing Trust, residents meet regularly with case managers. They get help with everything from drug counseling to transportation. The residents can also attend depression support groups or diabetes classes. Will Nebbitt spent 30 years living on the streets. He says at 58, he's too old and sick to be out there again.
It kind of takes a toll on a person.
Nebbitt has a seizure disorder and heart disease. He's had four surgeries. When he was homeless, Nebbitt didn't have a place to keep his medications, and he didn't go to the doctor regularly. Now, he says, it's much easier to take care of himself. The county's health clinic is just minutes away.
Just take an elevator 5 stories down, and I'm at my doctor's office. I can't beat that.
Nebbitt and Parra are two of about 850 people L.A. County has found housing for so far. But there are still about 12,000 more chronically homeless people living on the streets. Mark Trotz from the County Health Services Department says there are real consequences if they stay there.
They tend to die young on the streets, and they just continually recycle through expensive healthcare settings.
Will Nebbitt says he's grateful to be off Skid Row and in his own apartment.
That's my sanctuary. That's where I go for peace and quiet.
For Here and Now, I'm Anna Gorman.
And then there were 14 Republican presidential candidates. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie today announcing his candidacy for president in a speech at Livingston High in Livingston, New Jersey. That is his high school.
I am not running for president of the United States as a surrogate for being elected prom king of America. When I stand up on a stage like this in front of all of you, there is one thing you will know for sure. I mean what I say, and I say what I mean, and that's what America needs right now.
But it will be an uphill battle for Christie. A CNN poll of New Hampshire voters released last Thursday had Christie polling at 5%, seventh in the state, with an unfavorable rating of 44%. Still, in his speech, Christie described himself as a candidate united with the American people, fighting against the party machinery of Democrats and Republicans alike.
Both parties have stood in the corner and held their breath and waited to get their own way. Both parties have led us to believe that in America, a country that was built on compromise, that somehow now compromise is a dirty word. If Washington and Adams and Jefferson believed compromise is a dirty word, we'd still be under the crown of England.
Well, Christie is not the last candidate on the Republican side. At least that's not what we're expecting. We're still waiting on announcements from Ohio Governor John Kasich and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. That would bring the total number to 16 Republican hopefuls.
Recently, members of a chorus mingled before a weekly rehearsal in the basement of First Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Like most choruses, this is part about the music, much about the camaraderie.
Oh, that's so neat. Oregon, you're in the percent totems.
But this chorus is one of only two in the country that's exclusively made up of transgender men and women. The Butterfly Music Transgender Chorus was started last fall by longtime singer and vocal teacher Sandy Hammond, who quieted the small crowd and began warm-ups.
Ready, and... Yes, you can do octave down.
We sat down with Sandy and some chorus members, George Hasty and Lori Wolf. We started with Sandy, who is not transgender, but was inspired by someone who is.
About 10 years ago, I had a transgender man who wanted to get back into singing, and before transition stopped. And I was really moved by how terrifying it was for this person to relearn singing. Imagine living with your voice one way, your whole life. So on the one hand, it's very familiar, but you might also feel that it's not authentic, that it's not right for you. So then you go on this journey that might be with testosterone or however, whatever exploring your gender means, and you have to find a new voice, a different voice. In this person's case, testosterone had dropped their singing voice and speaking voice about an octave. So as a singer, I found that fascinating. I thought, how would I feel if I had to radically alter the way I speak, the way I sing, to relearn what range feels like, what expression feels like.
That's, who would think of that?
Right.
George Hasty, trans man, public health professional. I hadn't thought of this. Do you find yourself in the Hallelujah Chorus? Suddenly you're singing a different part?
Yes. I mean, I grew up singing alto, and now my voice is baritone, which is just a huge change, sort of mentally, to get used to that, and it's been great being in the chorus and like relearning. I haven't sung with a chorus since I did musical theater in high school, so it's been really exciting for me as my voice is still changing. It's in the middle of changing right now. I've been on testosterone about 10 months.
Yeah. Tell me about the speaking voice, how that's been different for you, just in speaking to people.
So it's been interesting because actually my singing voice changed first, much more so than my speaking voice. When I started singing with the group, it was early on testosterone, and my voice had gone to baritone with singing, but my speaking voice hadn't actually changed as much, which is sort of interesting. So it's actually only been in the last couple months, as I've been on a higher dose of testosterone and on it longer, that my speaking voice has actually gotten lower as well.
Lori Wolf, a trans woman, a writer, performer, poet, actor, activist, speaker, trainer, fundraiser. You have used your voice a lot.
I have.
But tell us about how it's changing for you musically.
The interesting thing is that after I transitioned or began transition, that tends to be a lifetime shift, I really had stopped singing. I was so concerned with presentation and being out in the world and finding this new self. But the piece of it that never really presented itself was the singing, because no one was looking for a trans singer. They weren't really interested in what I could offer as a singer.
What do you think that is that you offer that's different?
Well, I'm exploring and finding out what that is here.
A trans chorus is a brand new instrument. So soprano, alto, tenor, bass, that's the binary historical definition of a choral group, is out the window. So what I'm finding, low voices are a particular range on the keyboard. I can point it out to the singers. Middle is about C3 to C4 on the piano, C4 being middle C. Mm-hmm. And sopranos or altos or treble voice, if we're looking at sort of an upper range, right now is only about a sixth above that. So it's about 2.5 octaves, whereas SATB is 4.
Soprano, alto, tenor, bass.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it is a unique musical constellation of human expression. A trans man who transitions as an adult, the vocal cords thicken as a biological male would as a teen, let's say. When a teenage boy's voice changes, he also gets an Adam's apple. The area around the voice box gains about 1.5 inches in space. Well, a trans man doesn't have the Adam's apple typically, or that resonator. So it's a new instrument, and we don't really know what's possible.
And what about transing from male to female, as Laurie has? What happens to the chords there?
Yeah, basically zilch. Nothing happens. The physical changes that Sandy spoke of regarding the male vocal apparatus that happens in the first adolescence, that's not something that can be undone. That's a lifetime thing. So taking estrogen does not impact that.
But do you still change? I know you're not doing soprano, alto, tenor, bass, but have you symbolically moved yourself into the higher notes so that you're singing the notes traditionally sung by women?
The voice is, I mean, you exercise the voice and you learn how to sing. And so through the grace of the chorus and through doing work with Sandy, I've been able to bring my pitch higher. Just can reach those notes more easily.
Working.
And it's a pleasure.
Well, you've also given yourself permission to go to the higher notes.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, being trans, you give yourself permission to be yourself. And doing it with a voice is just a vitally important aspect of that.
George Hasty, again, trans man. What has it felt like for you to be singing?
It's been very joyful for me to sing with this group. I find a lot of community and camaraderie, and it's been wonderful finding my voice again. I get a lot out of it. And it's also exciting just adjusting to my voice, the pitch changing over time, learning from Sandy, learning from other folks.
Laurie Wolf, again, trans woman. It's a sense of community, I hear that. But what does it feel like to sing?
Singing is just such a beautiful expression of the soul, of the spirit. And for me, when I sing with other people who are also releasing that their soul, their spirit through word and song and just letting it out into the room, into the air, it's just very uplifting. In terms of finding your voice, when you can sing with other trans people and you can share that with the world, then it's a beautiful song.
A new study out from top academics argues that Google knowingly manipulates its search results, burying competitors and limiting consumers' options. And Google controls 70% of the global search market. It is worth noting, however, that the study was paid for by Google's rival, Yelp, and Google is refuting the findings. For more, let's turn to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Mark Bergen is associate editor at Recode. He covers Google, and he joins us from San Francisco. Mark, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And there are a lot of questions here, starting with, is this at all surprising? Google's been under investigation for this kind of thing in the past, that they're manipulating search results.
Correct, and they're currently under investigation right now in the European Union for a similar claim that they're using their search dominance to promote their own shopping product. And Yelp is making a similar claim around local search. So they conducted a study in which they used Google's current results around local search. So say you're looking for a restaurant in New York, and then they stripped out what they deem are all the what Google puts in with its own options, its own content, and they showed that consumers prefer the non-Google version, essentially.
Well, what would Google be emphasizing in its version?
Right. Well, Google uses a lot of different structured data, some of it around kind of maybe the accuracy of a map, or the value of a review, and kind of its mystery secret sauce of the algorithm. And Yelp's claims it also is promoting content that goes on Google Plus, which is Google's kind of very beleaguered social network.
Is that still around? I didn't even realize Google Plus was still there.
It is still around. And they still have businesses that have Google Plus pages and as part of Google Plus Local. So about 6 years ago, Google started to run what's called a one box, which is basically changing the search results. So now instead of what Google had from the onset, which was kind of 10 blue links, you have a map and then you have a curated list of the search results. And so Yelp's claim is that Google's defense in the FTC trial, now the EU as well, is that whatever they're putting forth is the best consumer option. Right? And Google always puts forth the product, the best search results for users. And Yelp's claim, and now with Tim Wu, the Columbia professor, is that this is no longer optimal for consumers.
And the reason that people are listening so closely to this and looking at this study is because Tim Wu, this legal scholar and former Federal Trade Commission advisor, has in the past said that Google was not doing this, that they were not manipulating their search results. And so the fact that he's now on board saying they are is striking to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. I think 2 years ago, Tim wrote a fairly eloquent essay defending Google when the FTC closed its search bias trial, basically saying that the fact that Google's built the best search engine is the reason why people use it, and it's not anything anti-competitive. Now he's claiming that these facts demonstrate that Google's actually using anti-competitive behavior, and it kind of opens the case up for an antitrust lawsuit.
And the fact that Yelp funded this study, that's not raising many eyebrows?
It's raising certainly eyeballs in Mountain View, where Google's located. But this is typical. Microsoft has done the same. Google's done the same, right? These are academics that they're paid, often paid for these kind of studies. I think that what's raising a little bit more eyebrows in Google is the claim that Yelp is kind of cherry-picking some results around local search, and the study is not really the best demonstration of how Google currently runs its search algorithm.
I suppose some people may look at this and say, why wouldn't Google do this? It's not a utility that's run by the government. It's a company. It's in the business of making money. Of course, they would want to promote the things on their search results that they want to promote.
Right. And I think this kind of, it's a larger trend where a lot of companies that work in the web world are getting very nervous, but what Google's doing is changing its search results, right? So recently, you ask for the weather in New York, and Google will stop kind of listing maybe the list of websites that list the weather, and they'll just put in the actual weather right then. It's done that kind of for more objective things, like, say, a math question or a recipe. And now it's moving into more subjective categories, like restaurant reviews or travel bookings or hotel recommendations.
And a lot of companies pay to have their results put higher up in a Google search. So maybe Google would be putting those results higher up just in the normal search results if it's a company that is paying Google anyway.
Absolutely. And you have companies like Yelp, whose entire existence is based, a lot of it's based on Google referral traffic. And so they really have to fight for their life to when Google makes changes, because Google has the ability to shake markets.
So what happens now with all this new information? Is Google going to face some legal action here in the U.S.?
That's pretty unlikely, but it depends on what happens in Europe. I think there's a much more higher chance of something happening in Europe. And there is a fine that Google's facing, which is upwards of $6 billion, which is not nothing, but still something that Google can manage. The more significant change for their business would be that the EU actually forces them to change the search results page and to change some of their algorithm. So that might happen in Europe, where you might see a very different search results page than you would in the U.S.
That's Mark Bergen, who is associate editor at Recode, talking with us all about Google, which is facing new allegations that they are manipulating search result data. Mark, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.